Previously on Beta.
Far be it from me to get in the way of a voyage of self-discovery.
And how do you feel about that? Depressed.
As I walk through this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, comedian Jonathan Katz. You might remember him from his animated Comedy Central sitcom, Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist.
But I do have a certain envy of Dr. Katz. Even though you could argue that he is me, he's so much better known than I am.
He'll join us a little later. And biographer Will Birch gives us the lowdown on the Jesus of Cool, Nick Lowe. The singer-songwriter could well be the role model for aging gracefully.
Elvis was very complimentary about Nick's embracing his age and his image and said, who would you rather be, Nick Lowe or Steven Tyler of Aerosmith? He said, Steven Tyler's a great character, but isn't that a rather lot of work every morning?
That's coming up soon. But first,
she's the most accomplished young detective in the history of the department. He's a third-generation cop who left Wall Street to honor his father's legacy. Together, they head the Impossible Crimes Unit, tasked with cracking the most unsolvable cases. When all others have failed, the ICU is the last hope for justice. When all others have failed, you call Black and White. This is their story.
That's an excerpt from Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. Charles is probably best known for the critically acclaimed novel, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. He's also worked for hit shows like Legion on FX and the HBO series Westworld. His television experience likely came in handy for Interior Chinatown. Structured like a script, the novel explores racism through the literal lens of the TV cameras. Charles talks about the inspiration behind Interior Chinatown.
Well, I've been wanting to write about a few things for years now, and I hadn't really found the way in. My parents are immigrants from Taiwan, and they've been here for more than 50 years. More than two-thirds of their lives, they lived in America as naturalized citizens, as Americans. And I've also got two kids, and they're 12 and 10 now, and they're reaching an age where they can ask questions, and they talk about things with classmates, and you know, they have questions around their identity and sort of both in terms of where do their families come from, but also are they real Americans? You know, they see the news. They see questions about immigration and questions about race and ethnicity as well. So, and I couldn't find a way in that felt true and that I would be able to do. You know, I mean, I certainly think there are very important, weighty ways to write about race and questions of who is an American and roles and stereotypes. But I wanted to at the same time have a different kind of approach. And I wanted to tell a good story that I hope is also entertaining.
So do you have an elevator pitch for Interior Chinatown?
I do. Yeah. You know, we've all seen Law and Order. Every few seasons, it seems they have a special episode set in Chinatown. And you've got the two leads and they're cops and they're discussing the case and they're in the foreground. And way in the back, almost out of focus, is an Asian guy unloading a van. And I wanted to tell a story about that guy, you know, van guy, who doesn't usually get a lot of lines and doesn't usually have a name. But in my book, he does have a name, and his name is Willis Wu. And Willis lives upstairs from a Chinese restaurant, and he lives in this kind of single-room occupancy place. It's like a dorm room, you know, for adults. And every morning, Willis goes downstairs and works at his job in this fictionalized cop show that I created called Black and White. And in the world of Black and White, Willis plays generic Asian man number three, but his dream is to become Kung Fu guy because that's the highest he can aspire to be in this world.
Mm, Yes. It's such a clever premise because you're exploring the racism that Asian Americans have experienced over the past 200 years through the lens, the literal lens of the TV cameras that are used to film the procedural police show Black and White in the Golden Palace restaurant in Chinatown. And of course, you wrote it in the form of a screenplay, TV script. You used the standard screenplay font, the typewriter font, Courier. Not all of these ideas came to you at once, did they?
Not quite at once, but it was one of those rare moments where the first line sort of fell out of my head, you know, and I was walking my dog, and it was 2017. It was after the election, and I don't think that's too coincidental. I think I'd started thinking about trying to tell a story that did have a bit more weight, and all of a sudden that line came to me, and the framework sort of presented itself, and I thought, am I really going to do this? Does it really work as a screenplay format? Do I have what it takes to carry it all the way through as a book? And I eventually decided I had to try.
What is that first sentence?
Ever since you were a boy, you've dreamt of being Kung Fu Guy, and then you are not Kung Fu Guy.
Right. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit more about the TV cop show, Black and White, that is filmed in the Golden Palace restaurant?
So Black and White is a Law and Order type procedural cop show, and I spent a lot of time, especially when my kids were babies and I was holding them, trying to get them to go to sleep, binging Law & Order, or binging SVU. And so that kind of formed the core of my sort of Law & Order knowledge. And so Black & White is a show where it's titled Black & White because in a very on-the-nose Hollywood trope way, there's a black cop and a white cop.
Yeah.
And the format is what you would expect. They find a dead body, they solve the case, and within the course of every episode, we get answers, and we follow a pattern. And where Willis comes into that, in terms of his story, is he plays a very small role, but in the course of the story, he's hoping to expand his role. And, you know, in the course of the story, we also see how the form and all of the other roles also lock in the performer. So it's not just Willis who feels trapped as generic Asian man. Black and White also feel trapped. And there are other roles as well that are limiting to the three-dimensional people that have to play them.
Your book features epigraphs from Bonnie Sui's book, American Chinatown. Can you tell me a bit about the first one and why you wanted to use it at the beginning of your book?
Yeah. This was part of this wonderful rush of things that happened right when I kind of decided to write it this way. Was I got to do a lot of research and look at sort of the history of Chinatown. And one of the things that I found out was that Chinatown does have this history of, at least LA Chinatowns had this history of being doubling as sets. Mm-hmm. And they played for Asia for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. But really what Bonnie Sui's getting at here in this quote is that it doesn't stand for any specific, you know, location. It stands for kind of the idea of an Asian exotic locale. And the point being that we don't, as viewers of the thing that's being filmed, we don't care so much where that is. We just know it's other, you know, it's supposed to be this kind of idea. And I thought that was the perfect way in to describe what the Chinatown that Willis Wu lives in is like.
Especially that last sentence, even today, Chinatown stands in for the ambiguous Asian anywhere, that ambiguous Asian, which figures very, very large in the course of your book. Yeah. Yeah. In her book, Bonnie says that Los Angeles Chinatown sends a signal to explore your cultural identity. And I'm wondering, was exploring your cultural identity something that you were trying to do, a goal you had when you were writing Interior Chinatown?
It was, to an extent. You know, my parents are immigrants from Taiwan, and I have grown up listening to their stories and have tried in my own way to pass along some of that to my own kids. But as a, you know, American who was born and raised here, I have a really sort of limited capacity to do that as a dad, as a person who passes cultural knowledge along. You know, my cultural knowledge is 80s sitcoms and video games. Among other things. And so it was about trying to explore cultural identity, but the specific cultural identity that I think I have as an Asian American, you know, both sides of the hyphen being relevant there.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn? Did you learn anything about your cultural identity? Did you reframe it, rethink it while you were writing your book?
I think it did help to see things through Willis's eyes. You know, in creating this character, I almost started to have a dialogue with a fictionalized version of someone that I could imagine knowing or someone that is drawn from parts of me. It is personal in some ways that I have often felt not part of the action or pushed into stereotypes. And until I wrote this book, I couldn't quite articulate exactly what that feels like or why it matters. And so, and I think the latter part is really was worth writing the book just in itself, is that I was able to articulate to myself why it matters.
Mm. You even extend the screenplay approach in Interior Chinatown to the acknowledgments, which, of course, you present in the form of the end credits of a movie. And you say that the 1956 book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life by my fellow Canadian Irving Goffman, was a big influence on your novel. Can you tell me how Goffman's book influenced your novel?
Yeah, I found his book years ago at a, you know, UCLA textbook store, and I was working as a lawyer then, and I just happened upon it. It looked fascinating, and I read it probably close to 20 years ago, and it's sort of never left my mind since. The framework that Goffman lays out is basically of the self as a kind of performance, and he talks about roles, and he talks about communication out of character and regions and all these kind of, if you imagine a stage, front stage and backstage, and how even in interactions as simple as like going to get coffee, mm-hmm. or, you know, waiting for an elevator or passing someone on the street, there's a kind of performative aspect to what we show to people and what we hide from people. And a great example of this would be like workers at a fast food restaurant who are rolling their eyes at a customer, right?
Right.
They're sharing something as people who are playing the role of, here's Taco Bell, you know, here's the front stage of it, and then here's the backstage of it. And that as a framework was, I think, the background of what Interior Chinatown is trying to do, is saying, yes, self as a kind of role, and then on top of that, what about an Asian American consciousness on top of that? And then where it got more exciting to me was not just that Willis is playing a role, but that all of these characters, black, white, Willis's parents, even the children, are playing roles. And that just was, Goffman's book is, you know, such a powerful tool for examining all of that.
Mm, yeah. When I think of racist portrayals of Asian Americans in American films, the first image that comes to my mind is Mickey Rooney's character, Mr. Yunioshi, in the 1961 rom-com Breakfast at Tiffany's. I'm curious to know, what do you think were the most damaging and racist portrayals of Asian Americans in the history of American film?
That's one.
Yeah.
you kind of already nailed it. I think Long Duk Dong, mm-hmm. 16 Candles for, you know, the next
right.
generation.
Yes, yes, John Hughes, yeah.
I think growing up, as I was born in 76, I guess I would have been sort of a teenager the first time I encountered that movie. And when you grow up not seeing any models that look anything like you, and mm-hmm. then that's the one you see, it doesn't take that much to be damaging. It just says, well, there you go. And I think what happened, at least to me, and what I'm trying to articulate in the book, is there's a sense in which TV is our reality. It's the one we're projecting out there. So it both shapes what we think of ourselves and it reflects what we're currently thinking. And that creates this kind of feedback loop where it reinforces what we already think about ourselves. And when you, for instance, see, like, let's say a hospital show where there are no Asian doctors, you know, I mean, there are definitely Asian doctors on TV now, but I mean, for years I watched shows where everyone at the hospital looked a certain way. Mm-hmm. And then you walk into a real hospital and you're like, where are all the Indian doctors on TV? You know, like
yeah.
half of these doctors should be Indian and all the nurses should be Filipino probably. Like if we're reflecting reality. So what we're seeing on the screen obviously is a highly filtered version of reality. And then you start to ask, well, why is the filter that way? Why does it seem to only strain out certain kinds of colors? And so scarcity of Asian roles for me growing up, and then seeing when they did pop up, seeing how stylized, and often now as a dad, I watch my kids looking at it. And even though, yes, they have some great role models that they get to see, still, we've watched TV recently where we're seeing non-Asians play what's essentially an Asian character doing an accent that they definitely don't have. There's progress, but there's also still room for improvement. And I was thinking, gosh, you know, on the one hand, we just watched Awkwafina accept the Golden Globe, or Crazy Rich Asians, or Fresh Off the Boat. You can see those shows on TV. And then on the other hand, you still have this, you know? And you still have casts where it's 19 beautiful blonde people, you know? Mm-hmm, it's like, then there's one ethnic part. You kind of know, okay, that's the ethnic part. And that's probably how that was written because, we can't have all of them be blue-eyed, but we can have most of them and we just need to make sure we fill the slot. I do wonder, though, in those two specific examples, you know, with Crazy Rich Asians, that's really a movie about Asians, not Asian Americans, you know?
Yeah.
And they're very
good
rich.
Point. Yes, yes.
And so it's this beautiful fantasy, and I was very entertained by the movie, but that's a different kind of story. And I think with The Farewell, which I loved that movie, Lulu Wang's movie, and Awkwafina was, you know, excellent in it. It's, again, it's an American going to China, and the movie takes place in China. With both this book and what I'm curious to see, are there going to be stories where Asian Americans can be part of the actual reality we see on screen the way they are in actual reality?
What more do you think Hollywood could and should be doing besides, of course, turning interior Chinatown into a major motion picture or a streaming series?
I think, you know, it's already partly being done, and it's what people have said, which is those stories generally need to be told by storytellers who have a different point of view. What I mean is that when we tell those stories and whoever's telling them authentically from a place, you know, a sincere place, that it is not a filtered version of reality, but it's actually acknowledging the messiness of real life. And that's kind of what I was getting at with the title Black and White.
Charles Yu, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Charles Yu is the author of Interior Chinatown. Find out more about Charles at wpr.org/beta.
We settled on the idea of therapy because you have traffic passing through your office, and especially if there were comedians, it could be wonderful.
Comedian Jonathan Katz revisits his famous character, Dr. Katz. The doctor will be with you in just a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do you have intrusive thoughts?
Impossible.
Thoughts that intrude on your ability to function?
Oh, yes, but they're created by me. They're not brought in from the outside. I misinterpreted the question.
All of your thoughts are created by you.
Yep.
That's the nature of thoughts.
Look, how abstract are you going to get in here? I mean,
blue?
What is your point?
All I'm saying is if you have intrusive thoughts, it's a mechanism of self-sabotage. It's your own mind interfering with your ability to enjoy life.
I guess I have them. I'll admit it.
Told you.
Remember the animated series Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist? It aired on Comedy Central in the late 90s and early 2000s. The show featured trademarked squiggly animation and a rotating cast of celebrity patients. Comedian Jonathan Katz starred as the professional therapist Dr. Katz. Now Jonathan's back with Dr. Katz, the audiobook. Featuring an all-star lineup including John Hamm, Mark Maron, and Jenny Slate, the audiobook reimagines the premise.
There's been all kinds of iterations of Dr. Katz, and it went from a cartoon to a stage production. I was doing Dr. Katz live, and when I made Dr. Katz, for me, it always seemed, when we did the cartoon, it always seemed like this wonderful radio show. And my favorite part was driving home from the studio and listening to putting a cassette in my car and listening to what I had recorded 3 weeks and not remembering anything of that.
Mm.
Because that's when I was introduced to the magic of digital editing.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's funny you say that. Not funny, but it's appropriate you say that because that's what I was thinking. It seems to me that Dr. Katz may be even more effective in the audio medium because you have such a great voice. And also, the squiggle vision animation in the TV version was kind of distracting, although it does have a certain charm and it kind of conveys angst. And there's something about the intimacy and the power of intimacy in the audio medium, radio, podcasting, and what could be more intimate than a therapy session?
You know, our experience with the animation was that for every 10 people who hated it, Mm-hmm. There were 12 people who didn't mind it that much.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm just, that was a Tom Snyder joke. He's the guy who was my creative partner in Dr. Katz.
Right, and it's not the Tom Snyder from Milwaukee. It's a different Tom Snyder. It's not Tom Snyder of The Tomorrow Show firing up the color teeny.
Nope.
No, not that. Anyway, that's my Tom Snyder. It's not very good. But anyway, so before you started doing Dr. Katz Professional Therapist, the original incarnation, the TV show, you spent something like 15 years doing stand-up. Did you enjoy doing stand-up?
I enjoyed a lot of it, but at some point I felt like I was trapped in a one-man show. And because I was so afraid to stray.
You welcome Jonathan Katz. Thank you so much. Nice to be back. I am in the clubs every night. I meet attractive women. You can imagine. Can't you? I was at a club last night. A lady follows me to the bar. She says, tell me, is it true? Do you really have a wife and a kid? I said, lady, this is an act. I'm not even bald.
First of all, a lot of my act was pre-recorded. I worked with this little guitar with a tape machine built into it. And I pretended to be singing, but it was really on tape. I pretended to be playing the guitar, but it was pre-recorded.
But it was you singing? It was just pre-recorded singing?
No, I actually wasn't there.
Okay.
No, I sang along with the recordings. But the recordings was something like I'd be on stage and you'd hear the recording say, oh my God, who is that exquisite looking creature sitting there?
That's good. Do you have a favorite joke that you told in your stand-up career?
I have a joke that I enjoy telling now. I don't know why I get a kick out of it, but I don't like to beat a dead horse, but it's not the worst thing I've ever done.
That's good.
Yeah. And, you know, I never thought of myself as a one-liner comedian, mm-hmm. but I guess I have a lot of those in my act.
You do, because you have this great quality. Well, you've got this great sort of very soothing voice. The other thing is that your timing is great. The pauses you have these great comedic pauses. Your timing is impeccable, I would say. John Benjamin portrays Dr. Katz's son, Ben. And I've read that when you met John when you were doing stand-up and he helped you realize there was a whole other approach to being funny.
Well, when we started doing Dr. Katz together, he comes at comedy from a totally different angle than me.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can write for John Benjamin because he'll just say something funnier.
It's about developing a relationship with your public. When you're a broadcaster, you'd know that.
Yeah, they'll get back to me when you're a broadcaster.
To be honest with you, Dad, it's about finding your own voice.
I bet the mic comes in handy for that one.
Shut your damn wise mouth. Hey, can I use that? About the mic? That'll break the ice.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I think if I can stick a joke in there somewhere, you know, they'd think I'm a fun guy to have around the booth.
Any rules you think that exist in improv don't exist for him.
Hmm.
We spent so much time just laughing out loud so hard. And sometimes, John Benjamin is one of two people who made me faint.
Yeah?
And it wasn't in the recording studio. It was in a Japanese restaurant in L.A., and we were just talking, and I was having miso soup, and the next thing you know, I'm unconscious, talking to my wife. The combination of soup and laughing doesn't work.
Hmm. Interesting. So what is the origin story of Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist? Why did you choose this particular premise, this you playing a therapist?
Well, a lot of that had to do with Tom Snyder, who is still my favorite person to collaborate with. And he, you know, we started with the biography of Mr. Katz, which was also fun, but it was just me doing my act and talking to a biographer voiced by this woman named Julianne Shapiro, who played Julie in the Dr. Katz TV show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that had kind of a limited potential, we realized soon. And so we settled on the idea of therapy because you have traffic passing through your office.
Yeah.
And especially if there were comedians.
Well, yeah.
It'd be wonderful.
Yeah, because comedians have this tendency to be miserable. Or is that a misconception? What do you think? Do you think comedians are?
I think they're very vocal about their unhappiness, often on stage.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think where I went wrong personally was I actually started believing I was a therapist, and I would try to make people feel better, which really was an awful idea because I made two people cry and one guy feel better in 6 years.
Mm.
And Tom thought it would be better if I wasn't in the booth with them. I was just, they went in there and they did their act and we added my voice later.
Yeah. Was the Bob Newhart show in which Bob played a psychologist in Chicago, was that an influence on Dr. Katz at all?
Not for me. Might have been for Tom.
Yeah, I just wondered because there's something, just the understated nature of so much of your comedy, it kind of reminds me of Newhart a little bit. Now, the character Jonathan Katz has the same name as you, Jonathan Katz, so which raises the question, how much of the professional therapist, Dr. Katz, is based on the real-life comedian, Jonathan Katz?
A lot. So much. It's frightening. In fact, my daughter, who's now 35, when she was a teenager, she once said, Dad, can't you make something up?
Can you give me an example of something that really happened to you in your personal life that you then incorporated into Dr. Katz's life?
There's an episode of Dr. Katz, which is one of my favorites, called Bully, in which Dr. Katz's son, Ben, loses his favorite stuffed animal, which was a stuffed bull.
Mm-hmm.
Which was when I was a child, my mother made me a stuffed bull.
Well, I guess I just expect an apology, Dad, because, you know, it just shows, I guess, a lack of consideration for my
should
stuff.
I apologize for trying to create an environment in which two adults can live?
Oh, what are you trying to say, that because I have a stuffed animal, I'm not adult?
I think you said it eloquently. No, all I'm saying is that we need the use of that closet, Ben.
I have human friends, too.
Well, do you keep them in the linen closet?
Would you throw them up?
Touché.
In one episode, your son Ben, played by John Benjamin, confronts you about something you did to him when he was a kid. And it was, can you tell me about that?
Oh, is this about his make-believe sister?
Yeah, tell me about that. That was one of my favorite, that's one of my favorite episodes.
I used to do this joke about my daughter was actually an only child, my real-life daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the only child in her class for many years. And she asked me why that was, and I said, look, Julie, you have a sister, but you're always missing her by about 5 minutes. that part is true, but what I do in the Audible book is I confess to Ben that when he was a kid, I made these recordings of his fictitious sister.
Dad, does this sound familiar?
Hi, Ben. My name is Annabelle. I'm your half-sister. You and I have the same mum. I grew up in Great Britain, but we summer in southern France, and I would love for you to come visit. I so do want to meet you.
Dad, does this ring a bell to you? Ring an Annabelle?
Oh, my God, Ben. Where did you find those?
In the closet.
Was it in the box called Mistakes I've Made with Ben?
Yeah, another one of my favorite moments in the new audiobook series occurs during Dr. Katz's session with Dimitri Martin. Dimitri describes Dr. Katz's voice as, quote, a weird mix of aggression and soothingness, end quote. Would you agree with Dimitri's description?
I don't hear the aggressiveness part.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yet, but boy, is he funny. He's so wonderful.
You know, I used to be a street performer. I started on the streets. It was hard. I was in the suburbs on a cul-de-sac, so it was not a lot of traffic.
Right.
But if somebody, you know, turned down there by mistake, I'd get them on the whole turn. And I did develop a certain style. I had a range, just, you know, in terms of the degrees. I could kind of pivot while I was playing. But
he says he's not superstitious. He says he thinks he has the regular amount of stish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You guys have a great back and forth. You guys have a great banter back and forth, as you do with all of your guests / patients, whatever we want to call them. Is there a comedian that you really want to get for the audiobook that you haven't been able to?
No, but I was thinking about Lily Tomlin the other night.
Yeah.
But she would be fun to have on the show.
Yeah, Lily Tomlin would be good. You have this sketch in an episode of your other podcast, this podcast you used to do, Hey, We're Back, in which Jonathan Katz, the comedian, has a session with Jonathan Katz, the therapist. And this raises the question, what kind of a therapy session would Jonathan Katz, the comedian, have with Dr. Katz, the professional therapist?
I don't know, but I do have a certain envy of Dr. Katz, even though you could argue that he is me,
mm-hmm.
he's so much better known than I am. His likeness, you know, I think that's the experience most cartoon characters have, is that nobody recognizes him.
Yeah.
But it's painful, the difference between the popularity of Dr. Katz and Jonathan Katz. On the other hand, when my grandchildren see me, they would thrilled that it's me and not Dr. Katz. How confuse them.
So if you don't mind me asking, is Dr. Katz based on any particular therapist that you may have seen over the years?
No, but I was living in Newton, Massachusetts, which has the highest number of therapists per capita of any city in the country.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, in Newton, if you run outside and scream you have issues, if you run outside screaming, somebody will toss you a bottle of Prozac. You know?
Oh, boy.
And I had, you know, I had therapists, real therapists who were consultants to me, who were also friends. And I once went to Toronto to perform for the American Psychological Audience, mm-hmm. American Psychiatric Society, I'm sorry.
Sure.
And they were the best audience I've ever had. They were afraid to laugh, but once they did, once they saw somebody else laugh, they were like putty in my hands.
I imagine you've heard from fans over the years who have told you that watching the original TV show has helped them to enjoy better mental health.
Oh, God. And some of them become therapists.
Oh, really?
Some of them become hospitalized. it's had an amazing impact on people, the show.
Mm, yeah.
And not just Americans. I get letters from all over the world. I assume they're about Dr. Katz because I only speak English.
Jonathan, you know what the music means. We're going to have to stop.
Oh, my pleasure was mine.
Jonathan Katz is a comedian and the man behind Dr. Katz, the audiobook. You can find out more about Jonathan at wpr.org/beta.
Nick Lowe received quite a lot of royalties when one of his early songs, What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Understanding, was picked up for the soundtrack of the Bodyguard movie.
Biographer and musician Will Birch joins us to talk about the life and music of one of Britain's greatest songwriters. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. And you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. During the 1970s, Will Birch was a drummer and songwriter for the Kersall Flyers and The Records. Later, he became a record producer. Now Will has put together the definitive biography of rocker Nick Lowe. Lowe pioneered pub rock, power pop, and new wave. He's best known for his songs Cruel to Be Kind and What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Dubbed the Jesus of Cool, Lowe's also known for his production work for Elvis Costello and his successful turn into a more stripped-down singer-songwriter. Will Birch's book is called Cruel to Be Kind, The Life and Music of Nick Lowe.
I think that Nick's influences obviously are early country music. When he was a boy, he grew up living to a large extent on Royal Air Force bases in Europe when his father was an officer in the Royal Air Force. So he did a lot of traveling as a child, and he often stayed on air bases where there were American airmen stationed. This is in the 1950s. And I guess those big air bases had a radio station that played music for the Americans. So Nick got to hear early country music in the 1950s, 1960s. And when he then sort of went to school and later college, he mixed with the crowd that would have been interested in the soul music of the mid 60s, you know, people like James Brown and Sam and Dave and Otis Redding, The Temptations, etc. So he was doubly exposed to both black and white American music. And as he has said himself, I think some of his aspirations are to sort of fuse those two genre, if you like, to produce something of his own that's unique.
Yeah, you're right. And he's, with a lot of his most recent work, done kind of what we could call country soul, music that's part country and part soul, and managed to combine them to form something new.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of his favorite songwriters is Arthur Alexander, a black singer, as we know, who really, I suppose, if you wanted to say, he was in the sort of soul category. But some of Arthur Alexander's songs are extremely pop, you know, like You Better Move On, which the Rolling Stones covered. And I know that Nick uses that song when he does a warm-up at the microphone before he plays a live performance. So he obviously loves that. He loves Arthur Alexander. And Alexander is probably a good example of somebody who's a soul-slash-bluesy kind of singer, but who has a sort of bit of a twang to it as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mention Arthur Alexander, because on that Arthur Alexander tribute album, Nick does a version of In the Middle of It All, and I think that's one of Nick's finest vocal performances.
And it looks like my life is about to fall. I tried to build a shell around it, but sadness has found it, and I'm in the middle of it all.
In August of 1976, Nick released the first single on the indie British record label Stiff Records, the self-proclaimed world's most flexible label. The A-side was a song called So It Goes, and the B-side, of course, was Heart of the City. What is your take on these two songs, Nick's debut as a solo artist?
Well, they're both extremely good songs, although different in style. And it's not too hard to detect the influences. I mean, I don't want to sort of accuse Nick of stealing, let's say, some of his tunes, but he'll be the first to admit he is influenced. And in Heart of the City, you do hear quite a bit of influence. Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, Roadrunner. Roadrunner going faster miles an hour, you know that record. And Heart of the City. You hear a big influence of Richman in that song, but Nick made it his own. So It Goes was similar in some ways to a couple of records Nick would have heard around 75, 76. Thin Lizzy had a hit record with The Boys Are Back in Town, Shuffle Rhythm. And in fact, Nick heard that song every night when he worked as road manager for Graham Parker and The Rumour, who opened up for Thin Lizzy on a UK tour. And also at that time, you also had Steely Dan's Reeling in the Years. Nick does actually admit that that was a bit of an influence on him for So It Goes.
I remember the night the kid cut off his right arm in a bid to save a bit of power. He got 50,000 watts in a big acoustic tower.
In the late 1970s, Nick Lowe became friends with the Welsh guitarist, singer, and producer Dave Edmunds, and they formed this band called Rockpile with guitarist Billy Bremner and drummer Terry Williams. The band played on Nick's second solo album, Labor of Lust, which featured the hit single Cruel to Be Kind. Can you tell me about this song?
Well, I think when Nick wrote Cruel to Be Kind, that was recorded with Brinsley Schwartz but not released. He says he was heavily influenced by the Chi-Town sound of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. They wanted to make a kind of soul record. I think that Ian Gom helped out with a couple of chords on that.
Oh, I can't take another heartache. Oh, you say you're my friend, but I'm at my wit's end. You say your love is bona fide, but that don't coincide with the things that you do. And when I ask you to explain, you say you gotta be cruel to be kind in the right measure. Cruel to be kind is a very good sign. Cruel to be kind means that I love you, baby. You
It was Greg Geller, who was the A&R guy from Columbia Records, who almost insisted that Nick make a version of Cruel to Be Kind to go on the Labour of Lust album. Cruel to Be Kind, which became quite a big hit in America, well, all around the world really, really benefited from Dave Edmunds' production skills and vocal harmonies and backing arrangement. Whereas Nick might have sort of shied away from putting too much icing on it, Dave, I think, in his instinctive hit-making second sense, realised, hey, man, here's a hit, let's really work on it, and they did. You say you gotta be cruel to be kind in the right measure. Cruel to be kind, that's the very design.
Cruel to be kind means that I love you. I remember reading this great quote about Rockpile. It was something along the lines of Rockpile was fueled by the same energy source as the punks, but they could play rings around them. And you have this quote from Clem Burke, the drummer of Blondie. Rockpile opened for them on a tour, and Burke says Rockpile was the world's greatest rock and roll band at that time. Would you agree with that?
Well, they were incredibly exciting. You said punk rock there. I mean, I suppose the Ramones fall into that camp, and for me the Ramones live were one of the great turns of that period. I mean, they were fabulous. I would say if you want straight ahead fast rock and roll with great guitar licks, harmonies and a fantastic swinging drummer, I still don't think there's anybody on the planet who could have beaten Rockpile, and probably not today. I mean, they were very, very exciting live.
Rockpile broke up in 1981, and Nick carried on with a solo career, but he reached this crossroads in his career. He decided that he would turn getting older into a distinct advantage. How did he do this?
Well, he's a thinker. He's not in any great hurry, and because he's not in any great hurry, and because his brain works in a certain way, which is slightly contrary to the way a lot of people would think, Nick, I think, took a step back and thought, well, either I can carry on with my sort of rock and roll shtick, or I can change course and I can be the first, the very first musician from the rock and pop music background who doesn't hide the fact that he's getting old. In fact, I'll turn it to my advantage. Not that he wanted his hair to drop out and go, well, he was already grey, but
yeah.
Not that he wanted to be look like an old man. He's still got bags of style, but he just wanted to take things to a level that I don't think anybody had really done before. There may be other examples, but he really did make a thing of being, you know, in his 60s and being like a very sort of non-rock and roll type artist that sings rock and roll songs. And I interviewed Elvis Costello for the book. Elvis was very complimentary about Nick's embracing his age and his image, and said, you know, who would you rather be, Nick Lowe or Steven Tyler of Aerosmith? He said, Steven Tyler's a great character, but isn't that a rather lot of work every morning?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great quote. One of the things that allowed Nick to reinvent himself was this unexpected financial windfall that he received in 1992, I think. Can you tell us what happened?
Nick Lowe received quite a lot of royalties when one of his early songs, What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Understanding, probably his second most well-known song that he'd previously recorded with Brinsley Schwartz in 75, was picked up for the soundtrack of the Bodyguard movie, which was obviously, as everybody knows, Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner. And it was a big, big movie at the box office. And like most movies, it had an accompanying soundtrack album. The way that came about was that Curtis Stigers, the American singer, jazz-inclined singer and musician, he had been performing that song in his club set for some time because he loved Nick's song. Curtis's version went on the soundtrack album, and that album went on to sell millions and millions. In fact, if you look it up, you'll find Arista Records claim it sold 45 million units.
Wow.
Worldwide. So yeah. One day the postman turned up with a rather large check for Nick.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity. Oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? Oh yes, and each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Understanding.
So because of this financial windfall, Nick was able to take his time with writing and recording songs. And he really reinvented his sound. He came up with this blend of country, soul, and blues, and he introduced this new sound on his 1994 album, The Impossible Bird. As you write in your book, the songs on this album were so strong that three of them were covered by Rod Stewart, Johnny Cash, and Diana Ross. One of the standout songs is called Where's My Everything? What inspired Nick to write this one?
Where's My Everything was a phrase that came out of the blue one night when he and his girlfriend were sitting around, and Tracy, his girlfriend then, made herself a cup of tea, and Nick said, where's my cup of tea? And then he went, where's my newspaper? Where's my pen? Where's my crossword puzzle book? And he said, where's my everything? And that was the inspiration for that song.
Where is the beautiful family home that I was promised on the news at 10? Like my personal place in the sun, it never happened alone. And as for the greatest love of all, that's been sworn in a billion lies, and is mine by birthright. Of it I've seen none. Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything?
And one of the best songs from this second act is called I Trained Her to Love Me. I asked Nick about this song in an interview a while back.
This song just got a reaction straight away from the audience. It's never happened to me before. And sort of divided the audience as well. That's a lot of the women realized that it was a sort of sympathetic song, you know, that I was sort of making fun of this character. And a lot of the men thought I actually sort of believed it. And there was a lot of kind of punching the air and saying, you know, yeah, Nick, way to go, man. As if I'd struck some fantastic blow for a men's lib.
What do you think of I Trained Her to Love Me?
Well, it's one of my absolute favorite songs of Nick's. It was just sort of a fantastic twist on relationships. I mean, it's quite audacious. It's quite conceited, really. But with his tongue a little bit in his cheek, but not too far. To take it to the level where, well, I made her love me so I could then ditch her, is quite conceited. But it's got enough humour in it that he can just about get away with it. I remember the first time I heard that, it was at a concert in London. He was singing solo acoustic in a big hall, the Barbican Theatre, maybe a couple of thousand people in the audience. And he put it in the middle of his set and you could hear a pin drop. And you could, as you sat there listening to this song being sung to the audience probably for the first time, there were men and women around. You could feel people like tightening up with, what's he saying, you know?
And the skip in her step when we're both out walking in the neighborhood. This one's almost done, now to watch her fall apart. I trained her to love me so I can go ahead and break her heart.
Will Birch, thank you very much.
Well, Doug, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and all good luck for future broadcasting.
Thank you, Will. I'm going to need it.
I should be ashamed. So what? I'm only paying back womankind for all the grief I got.
Will Birch is the author of Cruel to Be Kind, The Life and Music of Nick Lowe. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Speaking of Nick Lowe, one of my favorite things about Nick is his mischievous sense of humor. Back in the 70s, he came up with a crazy idea to get out of a record contract. He recorded a tribute to the Bay City Rollers, which he hoped would irritate his record company. There was only one problem. They loved the song and asked for a follow-up. But perhaps my favorite example of Nick's mirth and mayhem is his 1990 song, All Men Are Liars. It features this clever couplet. Well, do you remember Rick Astley? He had a big fat hit. It was ghastly. Nick was Rick-rolling before it became an internet meme. I guess you could call that Nick Rolling. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Charles Yu, Jonathan Katz, and Will Birch. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Fantastic. Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Does my voice sound booming to you? Do you recognize a healthy timbre?
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Well, you know, I want to be the guy that when, you know, at any point in any conversation I'm having over the radio, I can press a button and like a wacky sound comes on. Like a ba-dong!
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
I'm more like an entertainer. I mean, there's a lot of news out there, but that's not what people want to hear.